life, and that is that life is uncertain. The best laid plans can be altered or ruined by unforeseen circumstances. You never know what's going to happen. You cannot predict everything is going to happen. I was just talking to someone yesterday about a story I saw on the news where a lady was traveling in the south there down a highway with her two children in a car, and a 9-foot alligator crawls out onto the highway. Who saw that coming? She hit the alligator, it flipped the car and killed her and her children. Now that's just horrible. And yet you think to yourself, what happened here? Here's a person who's probably on their way to somewhere, taking their children, didn't think anything that this was going to be their last day on earth, and yet it was. And that we have probably thousands of stories like that we could all collect together that we've heard or know about, where people were just on their way to somewhere else, just on their way to doing something else, and then life took a turn. And either it ended up in sickness or in the hospital or in some kind of tragic situation or even in their own deaths. So the best laid plans are uncertain. They can't guarantee them. We can't guarantee them. No one is guaranteeing them. Things fall apart. The world, the universe is in constant erosion, depletion, loss of heat and energy. Or the transition of energy, I should say, what the scientists tell us is called entropy, means that everything is winding down, it is not winding up. Okay, so people are striving to overcome the odds, the hurdles, the obstacles, the limitations, but ultimately they will fail. They all will lose energy, they will lose heart, and all people will die. Eventually, everyone succumbs to what the Ecclesiastes writer says in chapter 9, verse 11, time and chance. In other words, you're going to run out of time, or you're going to run out of, in essence, chances, or the overcoming part of this physical world. Perfection, then, is either elusive or short-lived. It's a pretty dismal way to open up a lesson, but I'm making a point here. This is all very depressing. If you view only this life, if your context is focused only on this life, then that's what you have. That's all you have to look forward to. But now the good news. God's world never deteriorates. His light never fades. His word never fails. His love never ends. His people live forever because God never ages, never decreases, never is depleted in energy, and does not die. Now we have the contrast. We have the world that's falling apart, that's deteriorating, that cannot be guaranteed. Life can throw you a curve at any time. There's no way that you can stop it from happening. And that curve may be the end of you here in this life. Or we have God, who is not going to have any curves thrown at him, who is in charge of all things, who cannot be defeated, cannot be destroyed, cannot be overcome by anything, cannot fail, cannot falter, cannot lie, cannot fail to do for you what he promises. Which one do you want? Is really what Jesus is posing to us in this passage. Which one seems right to you? Since there is a God, there is an afterlife, and you have a soul, those three things are the premise of everything that we're saying, and we could take time to prove them to the point that is needed if we had the time this morning. Since those things are true and they do exist, then preparing your soul for that afterlife is the best thing that you could do. Investing in your heavenly future leads to a great reward. But if you fail to do this, well, then you are facing, and this is guaranteed, absolute and utter disappointment and regret. So Jesus just lays the thing out here for us, doesn't he? Keeps doing that throughout this whole Sermon on the Mount. And, you know, he's not saying that, you know, you're being forced to do one thing or the other. He's not twisting your arm. He's not threatening you with hellfire and brimstone, per se, in his words. He's just calmly trying to appeal to your intellect and to your reasoning and say, which one sounds best to you? His message is simple to understand, and yet it is profoundly wise and immensely important. Invest your treasures wisely first, then your heart will follow. Your heart will be where your treasure is. And if your heart is in heaven, that is good because that's where Jesus is. Jesus is in heaven. We're going to look at Matthew chapter 6, first of all, verse 19 through 21. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, it says, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So Jesus addresses two categories of loss or depletion. First of all, you have the natural world, the physical world that we live in, and then you have the sinful world, the world of sinful men, if you want to look at it that way. So the moth and rust refer to the effect of nature, the corruption, the deterioration that comes from nature, the decline in value that comes naturally, in the natural world. This effect is not sinful because nature is not capable of moral decisions, but it is destructive nonetheless. Leave something outside long enough and it's going to deteriorate. Doesn't matter what it is, okay? And some of you know this, right? You've left lawn furniture or a car or, you know, something outside, and over time it just deteriorated. It just disintegrated. Well, that's nature taking its effect. That's nature taking its toll, if you will, on those things. And then there is the effect of men, or the effect of people. Thieves will break in and steal whatever you have. This is loss due to greed and selfishness. And this is sinful. This is a decision that people are making. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 11 says, when good things increase, those who consume them increase. Isn't that true? When you get good things, there's always someone out there who wants your good things. Okay? And if you had nothing, well, then you don't have any problems because nobody wants your nothing. Okay? But as you increase things, as you multiply things in your life, there's going to be someone out there, no matter how well you guard against it, who wants what you have and will probably try very hard to get it. Why do you think we're having so much theft right now? And in not just in this area, but we have identity theft, we have electronic theft, we have physical theft, we have all kinds of theft going on. Why is that? Because we have stuff and that people want. There's that greed effect there. So what I'm saying, well, really what Jesus is saying is you're going to lose out on both cases. In the natural world where you live, even if you lived on an island all by yourself, the natural world is going to take its toll on you. Or if you live among people, well, they're going to take their toll on you. And if you live in a world, a natural world where people are, well, then you've got both sides taking their toll on you. So Jesus says, in essence, that this world is unstable. It is imperfect. Why put your treasure here? Especially when you have access to something so much better. You have access to perfection. Even more importantly, why would you put your treasure in the physical world when it's a spiritual part of you that goes on past this world? Is really the implication here. And your spiritual world is going on to a spiritual world. By the way, you're already in the spiritual world spiritually, but you haven't seen it yet. You just haven't realized it yet. But you will in due time. Now keep in mind, Jesus is speaking to Jews who centuries earlier were addicted to cultic idolatry and the lifestyle that accompanies that. Conquest and exile certainly broke them of that, but now they have a new form of idolatry, and that is called money and greed and self-indulgence. And I think that's where America fits in right now. This is what we're faced with in our modern age. This is the idolatry of today. Luke 16, verse 14, it says there plainly that the Jews were lovers of money. I don't believe that means every single Jew, but the Jews as a people, and certainly the Jewish rulers who sought that treasure of that lifestyle, that was what they loved. That is what they coveted. Luke chapter 16, verse 19, talks about the rich man, the story of rich man and Lazarus there. And it says that he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, joyously living in splendor every day. Because that's what these Jews were looking for, is joyously living in splendor every day. Because their treasure is here with their family and friends. And I think that we're being faced with that same thing today. You know, family and friends takes precedent over spiritual values and spiritual treasures. We're putting an awful lot of emphasis on a bunch of people who can't help us, who can't save us, who are robbing us in many cases of the things that we should be paying attention to. But recognize that once that man left this world, that rich man who was once rich and living in splendor and joyously, indulging in that lifestyle, now he is penniless, now he is in torment, and now he is alone. So there's a man who failed to listen to the good advice of God, to the instruction of God, and he lost everything. So these treasures that Jesus spoke of is really whatever your heart longs for, whatever you are devoted to, whatever takes priority over everything else, whatever is chosen above all else. For some people, it might be, you know, like I have a picture here of a very nice car, Pierce Arrow, by the way, if you didn't recognize that. And for others, it might be a nice house, or for others, it might be their children, or, you know, just their lifestyle, their social circle. It might be money itself, of course, and it might be power. It might be, you know, just whatever leverage they have or whatever advantage they're seeking in this life. It doesn't really matter what your treasure is. It's where your heart is right now. Okay, because your heart is where your treasure is. So wherever your loyalty is, and don't think just only of money and gold and silver, it can even be something worthless and useless, because as you know, one man's junk is another man's treasure. Okay, and so similarly, what is precious to God may be regarded as useless to men or to the man of the world. So what is important to God, what is treasured with God, may be useless to someone else, may be junk. And isn't that what Paul says, like in 1 Corinthians 1:18, where he says, you know, that the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. It is junk to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. It is a treasure. So just think about that. We have other places in the Bible we could go to that confirm this in other way. Plainly said, what is important to you or what seems important to you or me may not be very important to God at all. In fact, there is a passage. It's outside of your notes there. But in Luke chapter 16, right before the account, I should say, of the rich man and Lazarus, in verse 15, Jesus says to the Jews, after verse 14 says they're lovers of money and were scoffing at him, it says, "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God." So it doesn't mean that just because something is valuable to you that automatically it is valuable to God, is really what we're saying. Someone says, well, my family and my house, my car and my, you know, my retirement, these are all extremely valuable to me. And God isn't saying they're not valuable at all, but if you're using those things or placing those things ahead of God, then you render God invaluable. You render God less valuable than those things. So Jesus says, store your treasures, whatever your heart longs for, whatever deserves your highest priority, store those things in heaven where God is, above the corruption and deterioration, the loss, the insecurity, even the greed of this world. And we often overlook that word store. Literally in the Greek, it means to lay up or in reserve, or literally means to treasure. What Jesus is saying in the Greek is treasure your treasures. It's literally how that comes out in that passage. Treasure your treasures. The idea of storing something for the future, for future use, obviously implies some things. First of all, it has some intrinsic value. It is worth saving. Why else would you store it unless you thought it had some value, right? Or it will be safe and protected so that you could have future access to it. And, of course, that you're going to need that thing, whatever it is you're storing, in the future. And that lesser things that you're not storing don't require that safety and protection. They're just not worthy of that kind of care or attention. And so it is with your soul. Think about that. Here is something that's worth saving. It's priceless. If you lose your soul, you just can't go get another one. If you lose your soul, you have no recourse. Once it's lost, it's gone forever. There's nothing you can do about it. You're going to need your soul in the future. Whether you think so now or not, doesn't matter, but you want it in the future, and you want it in excellent condition in your future, don't you? So it's worth storing in some good place. It will be safe and protected in God's care. And lesser things, all the things that nature and men can destroy, those things will not matter in the future. I guarantee this because Jesus guarantees it, that when this life is ripped away from you and you're staring at God face to face there, that all the things that take up our time and our attention right now are going to just melt away and not be important, unless, of course, they are the things of God. That's what's going to be important. And if you don't have any things of God in your life, or if those things were minimal or unimportant to you now, well, then there's nothing that you can do about it at that point. Jesus is trying to spare you from all of that, trying to spare you from being in that absolutely horrifying situation. Well, so just imagine, if you had something very valuable that you had to entrust to someone's care, who would you choose? Would you just pick some guy out here on the street? Say you've got a diamond ring or just a suitcase of money or just some priceless heirloom. Would you just tap someone out here on Kent Kangley or down at Kent Station or something like that and say, hey, excuse me, I've got a suitcase of money. I was wondering if you could keep charge of this for me. Would you do that? I hope not. Okay, unless I'm that person, then I will do that for you. But would you give those things to someone who you know is a thief and who steals on a regular basis? He's a known thief. Would you hand over your suitcase to that person? Why would you do that? That just doesn't even make sense. But see, this is what people are doing in this world already. They're giving their soul to a complete stranger, or they're giving their soul to someone that is a known thief, or they're giving their soul to someone that can't protect it. They're giving their soul away. Jesus says, leave your treasures with God. Let him take care of that, because he is fully capable of safeguarding and protecting everything that you have, your future, your soul, your treasure, far more than family and friends or even yourself could do. Listen, a lot of people putting a lot of weight. I hear it all the time on the social media and everywhere else, how important our children are and our children and, you know, our children and our children. And I understand that. My children are very important to me too, and I hope they're important to the world in some way. But listen, I cannot entrust my soul to my children or to my wife or to anyone else but God, because in the end, my children and my wife are all going to be gone, and I'm going to be staring at God face to face. And he's not going to ask me, hey, at least, did you entrust all your valuables to your family? That was a good move on your part. He's not going to say that. You know that. You and I have no control in the afterlife. God has all control. Who do you want to give your treasure to? But if you say that I don't trust God with my treasures, I trust my friends instead, or maybe I trust my bank or my financial advisor, or maybe I'll just take care of it myself. I trust my treasures to myself. I can't trust anyone else. Well, Jesus has something to say to you. He says, whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, which is another way of saying if you want to keep your own treasure for yourself, to yourself, well, then you're going to lose everything. But he who loses his life for my sake will find it. Which side of that do you want to be on? Is really the question he continues to pose. Well, here's a related passage. I know that it may not seem so at first, but Matthew chapter 6, verse 22 and 23, Jesus says, the eye is the lamp of the body, so then if your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? Which is true. If that's all you have, if darkness is the only light you have, then that's pretty dark, right? Is kind of what he's saying, kind of a paradoxical way of looking at it. So the physical eye obviously provides information so that you know which direction to go, and you know what's in your path, and you know what can cause you to stumble. Jesus uses this in a spiritual way to talk about the quality or the condition of one's heart. And as you know, and light is a common and well-used symbol in the New Testament. Light symbolizes life. If you've read 1 John at all, you'll see constant references to light and darkness. Light means walking in fellowship with God. Walking in darkness is spiritual ruin or destruction. Light is essential for health and growth and productivity. Darkness is the antithesis of all of that. Here you can prove it, by the way. Just get yourself a little patch of soil there and put all kinds of water and nutrients and seeds in there, vegetable seeds. You're going to grow a little vegetable patch, but make sure that you cover it over completely with a tarp that allows no light to penetrate that at all, and see what kind of vegetable garden you get from that. You can't grow things without light. And you can't grow people without spiritual light. You can't do that. And this is not just a fact of nature, it's a fact of human nature as well. And that is what God is telling us. That's what Jesus is telling us. We have to be filled with light if we're going to grow and succeed. Someone says, what does this have to do with treasures in heaven? Well, you have to have an accurate appraisal for what a treasure is in the first place. What is valuable? What is worth protecting? Many people, and when I say many people, I include Christians in that, many people are placing a high value on things that in the end cannot help us, that they have in essence zero value. They're placing high value on zero value things. It's like paying $100,000 for a Ford Pinto. We don't even have Pintos anymore. What would we use? A Ford Tempo, okay? I could just say a Ford. But anyway, probably offend somebody if I did that. But you know what I'm saying, that there's vehicles out there that just, they're throwaway vehicles. Why would you spend a whole lot of money on them? They're not of any value. So imagine saving up all your life. There's a painting or something like this. Let's just use a painting illustration here. There's a painting that you have access to that you can buy, but it's going to cost you an entire life's worth of savings. And you do that. You save up for this painting, and you finally, at the end of your life, you have all your money together, and you pay out all that money. You give everything you have to get this painting, and now you get the painting, and you find that it's a forgery. I believe that's what's going to happen to a lot of people. They're spending a lot of time, a lot of money, all of their life's effort and energy, accumulating everything they have and giving it in essence to a forgery. So, what kind of eye do you have to have? You have to have an eye that allows the light to come in so that you can see what is true value, what is truly valuable. You have to have an accurate appraisal for the future, an accurate appraisal of what treasures are in that future. 1 Corinthians 2:14, Paul says that a natural man, a man of the world, sees no value in treasures in heaven because he has no faith in God. Children of the kingdom, however, should know what is valuable and should know then to invest in that. Physical blindness, as you know, is bad enough. Spiritual blindness is far worse because that person cannot see God, cannot see the light of God, cannot see the light of the gospel or even the joy and beauty of heaven. We're told that in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 3 and 4. Paul talks about, by implication, that greed and false hope and disbelief, all these things that come from Satan, they blind people to the light of the gospel, the glory of God, and the joy of salvation. Those people are blinded to that. And it doesn't have to be that way. This is like a chosen blindness, like you're, you know, sticking a sharp stick in your own eye. It's a chosen thing. It's not something that happened to you. It's something you chose to happen to you. It's something you chose for yourself. And it can certainly, in the case of spiritual blindness, it can be undone because Jesus is the healer of the blind. Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, Jesus says, no one can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. I'll talk about that word wealth here in just a minute. But the fact is that no one can serve two different lords with equal devotion. Jesus says it's impossible. I know many people have lost their souls trying to prove him wrong. Jesus says it's impossible, so I'm going to go with that it is impossible. Now, Paul says the same thing, but he explains it a little differently. He says in Galatians 5, 16 and 17, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh, for the flesh sets its desire against the Spirit against the flesh, for these are in opposition to one another. Well, there's the two masters right there. You have the Spirit of God, and then you have the flesh, which is really, in essence, human desire, human cravings, the desire for this life and this world. Okay, so Paul says the same thing, and he says that these two masters are enemies of each other. It's not a passive, peaceful coexistence. It's not like they're both getting along, holding hands, you know. It's that they are in opposition. There is a war between the two, between the spirit and this world. You choose one master or the other, but you can't serve them both. Paul and Jesus saying the same thing. And don't assume for a minute that when Jesus says wealth, that he's talking only about money and dollar bills and that sort of thing, that that's the only master to choose other than God. Elsewhere, Jesus has talked about many people being mastered by positions of power and authority. or being mastered by their friends and their family, or being mastered by the praise and the applause of men, or being mastered by earthly pursuits of any kind, or simply being mastered by this life itself, or even being mastered by Satan himself. Don't think that just money is your only problem, and if money is not a big deal to you, then you're okay. You need to figure out what's mastering you. What have you chosen to be your master? That word wealth comes from an Aramaic word, mammon, which literally means whatever you put your trust in. It's kind of hard. It's all the scholars say it's a hard word to put into English, but it basically, wealth encompasses whatever you put your trust in. Jesus says it's wherever you put your treasure. Just as you cannot walk the wide path and the narrow path at the same time, so you cannot give allegiance to two different masters equally and successfully. It cannot be done. All right, so there's the passage as far as our exposition of it is concerned. Now we want to look at some practical lessons here regarding those passages. Obviously, Jesus is talking to the Jews of his day, but that message that he just gave them is a timeless one. It is a universal one because it's a message of moral truth, and morals never change. Morality never changes. It's always a constant. Moral lessons, therefore, are always constant. So when Jesus says, do not store up treasures on earth, well, who dares disagree with that, right? Doesn't that just make sense? Isn't that like one of those things that like everyone goes, yeah, that makes sense. You know, I can go along with that. It seems to be obvious, given the brevity of this life and the eternity of the afterlife, this makes sense. Given the emptiness and the hopelessness of the world and then the beauty and the eternalness of heaven, well, again, this just makes sense. And you would think that, since something makes so much sense, that everybody would be latching on to it and following after that, doing everything they can to support that, which makes sense. But we show the world and each other what really makes sense to us, what we really believe and what is truly important to us by what we invest our time and energy in. You might call it our go-to. I know I keep hearing that in our modern vernacular. What's your go-to, right? Well, your go-to is wherever your treasure is. And there will be your heart also. So whatever your go-to is, when you have downtime or when you have, dream time, or if you could create a perfect world in which you could do anything, your go-to, that's what that becomes. I'll tell you what, I'm being real honest with you. I am tired of talking about worldliness and materialism. I just get sick and tired of talking about it. I really do. And yet these are the things that are sucking the life out of our Christians, sucking the life out of our brethren. They're poisoning our minds. These things are ruining our marriages. These things are stealing our young people's hearts. They are robbing us of the joy of discipleship, and they're robbing God of his honor and his service. These things are destructive, corrosive in nature. And when we see Christians going back on what they had promised God or what they promised their congregation, we often call that a commitment problem, right? Start to categorize, he's got a commitment problem or she's got a commitment problem. When we see Christians putting love for their family ahead of their love for the Lord, even though they promised otherwise, we call that a priority problem. And when we see marriages suffering due to selfishness and parents failing to lead their children, even though they've been taught, over and over, and we see lack of leadership, we call that a listening problem. But here's really what it all boils down to, what all those problems have in common. It's a heart problem. It is a problem of misplaced treasure. That's what it all comes down to. You can call it what you want to. You can try to redefine it if you want to, but ultimately it always comes down to a heart problem. And what has Jesus been telling us through this whole Sermon on the Mount? He says you got to get your heart in the right place. And the only way to get your heart in the right place is to have your treasure in the right place. And if your treasure isn't in the right place, then your heart won't be in the right place, no matter what you say, or what church you go to, or what religion you believe in. It doesn't really matter in the end. Christians put more value in this life, and in the here and now, and whatever they got going on in their little world, than they do in God and his world at some times, even though they claim otherwise. Is this a struggle with all of us at one way or another? I think it is. I struggle with this myself. where we're constantly having to re-examine, re-evaluate, re-measure, recalculate. We have to do that because this world is not content to just let us have a belief system and then go, oh, okay, well, I'll move on to someone else. You know, this world wants us, targets us because of our beliefs. The heart not satisfied with God will always seek to satisfy itself with something or someone else. Think about that, what I just said. The heart that is not satisfied with God will find its satisfaction in something or someone else. And when we see people, myself included, when we see people, anyone, looking for their completion in something other than God, what they're really saying is, I'm not satisfied with God. And what they're really saying is, my treasure is not in God. They don't have to come out and say it in those words. You don't have to bow down to a graven image to be guilty of that. You just need to put something or someone ahead of God. This is a problem that we're facing. This is a problem that can be resolved, a problem that we can overcome. But we've got to give good attention to it. Think about it in this way. Matthew chapter 13, verse 45 through 47, if you turn with me there for just a moment. Now, he's using treasure in a little bit different way here, but nonetheless, it's going to work for what we're saying here. He's likening the kingdom of heaven to a merchant seeking fine pearls, and upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. I wanted to start in verse 44, actually. I got 45 there. Now, let's go back up to 44. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again. And from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. So here we have a man who finds a treasure in a field, or a man who finds a pearl of great price here. And one thing I find very interesting is I noticed that no one had to convince either man what to do once they found it. No one had to go, and you know, the guy standing there looking at the treasure going, huh, there's a treasure worth a lot of money. There's a field I could buy. And then someone comes up and taps and says, you know what you should do? You should buy that whole field and get the treasure. That's a good idea. You know, no one has to do that. Why is that? Because when he sees the treasure and he understands the value, he is prompted by that thing itself to do what needs to be done. If I want that treasure, then this is what has to be done. If I want that pearl, then this is what I have to do. He sees the quality, the worth, the value of the treasure itself, then that motivates appropriate action. And since both men in this illustration have a good heart, otherwise they wouldn't have valued such treasures, right? Going with the moral aspect of it here. Since both men have a good heart, they just needed access to the right treasure. In our day and age, as increasingly secular-minded thinking spills into our churches, this is not the case. The quality of spiritual treasure has not changed, but many hearts have and don't value what is valuable to God, don't value what God has to offer. Here's a way you can test yourself. If someone has to constantly remind you, just think about the last few weeks or months or years, if someone has to constantly remind you to be faithful, to honor your commitments that you made yourself, if someone has to constantly tell you, hey, you should tell the truth, you should be honest, you should be faithful to what you said, you should read your Bible, you should assemble with the saints when the saints meet, you should get busy with God's word. If someone is constantly having to prod you and remind you, I'm telling you, your treasure is not in the right place. Because if your treasure was in the right place and you valued that treasure for what it is, no one would have to remind you to do any of those things. I'm not saying you might need some instruction or education as to how to do those things. I would be saying that you would be showing up and saying, here I am reporting for duty. What can I do? I'm ready. I want to do this. You want me to assemble on Sunday? I'll do that. Wednesday, I can do that. Go to someone's house? I can do that. Help serve someone? I can do that. Write a card, write a letter, make a phone call? I can do that. I want to help. There's someone who has a treasure in the right place. People who put their treasure in the world, then you go up to them and say, hey, brother or sister, can you do this little tiny thing? They're like, do I have to? Let's see if I can work it into my schedule. Because they've got, you know, their life in the middle, and you know, church, God, religion's all on the outside. And it just interferes with, you know, what they got planned. I often say jokingly, you know, that work keeps interfering with my vacations. But I do think sometimes there's a truth to that, how we think about things. Like, you know, life is always, you know, just one big vacation, but I got this duty stuff I got to do. I would want you to turn that around and say, actually, we have duty and responsibility at the core of it. And every once in a while, you get a perk called a vacation or a day off or, you know, a bonus or something like that. So test yourself. Who's having to constantly remind you, and why are they having to do that? Are you the one having to be reminded to do the very, very basic things that Christians are called to do? People whose treasure is in heaven, they don't have to be reminded of what to do or to when to do it or when we meet or who needs attention or to be submissive to our elders. We don't have to tell them to do that. They're ready to do that. They're eager to do that. They want to do that. Because their treasure is in the right place, their heart is in the right place. They're looking for an opportunity. They recognize the value of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, and they're gladly willing to give up their lives for that. Now, that's the one side of it. Here's the other side of it. Jesus is offering a warning, but he's also offering a grand promise. That if you do put your treasure in heaven, then you will receive that treasure in full in due time. James 1:12 says it this way, since we're in the James class here, it was on my mind here. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. So there's the other side of it. Yeah, there are some warnings, there are some admonitions, there are some struggles, there's some difficulty, but here's the plus side. There are some grand rewards to look forward to. Better than you can ever find in this life. Better than any vacation has to offer in this world. So what do? We have work to do. We have trials to face. And we have God's approval to gain. We have a race to run. We have people to serve. We have people that need teaching. We have a mission here to fulfill as a congregation. We have a Savior to follow. We have all those things to do. All this is difficult, I'll grant you that, but it's all doable as well. Difficult, but doable. And then Jesus comes along and says, and I'll be your advocate. And the Spirit comes along and says, and I'll lead you. And then God comes along and says, and I will welcome you. You're not going to get that kind of help among us from me. I can't even provide that level of help. God says, just take my hand. Let me lead you. And all will be well. You might say, well, this is difficult or scary, or I'm afraid of what I'll have to lose, or, you know, what I'll have to do. Don't worry about it. God says, I'll take care of you. Do you trust me? Do you trust me? When Jesus talks about the lamp of your body, what he's really talking about is the honesty and sincerity with which you dedicate yourself to God. If your heart is good and healthy and full of light, well, then you can appraise things for their true worth or their true value. You can see by faith the work of God in this world. You can see by faith the world passing away in the end. You can see by faith the end of all things, but you can also see by faith your soul's future glory with God in heaven. You can see all that because you've got your eye open and it's filled with light and your heart is full of light and you can see those things. But if your eye is bad, well, then you're filled with darkness. And here's the problem with that. Someone will say, usually, of course, a Christian will say that is full of darkness but wants to be regarded with the status of a Christian, they say, I see, and yet that person is blind. You think about Colossians 3, verse 1 through 3. Colossians 3, verse 1 through 3, Paul says, set your mind on the things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind there, not down here. Set your mind up where your treasure is supposed to be. And that's where your heart will be. And that's where your thoughts will be. And that's where your intentions will be. But those who are blind, they don't have that value. They don't have that sight. They don't have that vision. They are not looking upward. They're looking downward. They see petty, temporary things appearing to them to be important, and the important things appear to be expendable. In other words, they got it all backwards, but they claim to see. The will of God is replaced by their own self-will. You know, I just want to be happy, and God knows that I want to be happy, so I'm just going to follow my heart. You know, listen to any Academy Award or Oscar speech. What does it always say? You know, you just need to follow your heart. Really? I'm thinking that's my heart that got me in trouble in the first place, honestly, with God. I need to quit following my heart if my heart is in the wrong place. So don't follow your heart initially. You only follow your heart when your heart is following God, okay? But if your heart is somewhere else, then you ought not to follow that. And that's why I'm not nominated for any Oscar performance right there. Just someone gets wind of that. Galatians chapter 6, verse 3, if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Notice it doesn't say the church has deceived him or the preacher deceived him or even Satan deceived him. It says he deceives himself. We can be self-deceived. So if anyone says, well, my treasure's in heaven, but he talks and thinks and lives in a way that is contradictory to one who has his treasure in heaven, guess what happened? He has deceived himself. He can blame it on Satan or, you know, the lack of teaching or the church didn't do this or whatever. But the fact is, he's living in darkness. His eye is bad, his heart is darkened, and he's deceived himself. Well, thankfully, that can all change. I told you, God is a powerful healer. He can change all that, but you've got to give him your consent to do so. The point I'm making here is that we, Christians and non-Christians alike, cannot afford to base our soul's future on a false hope or on a false God or on self-deception. This is why we are supposed to test ourselves, as Paul says. Test yourselves to see if you're in the faith. Examine yourselves. Or do you not recognize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you fail the test? There it is, right there. That's what you and I should be doing. Notice it doesn't say, go to see if you're in the church directory, and if you are, it's all good. It doesn't say that. Or go to church, and it's all good. Or sit on a pew and listen to sermons. There's your test right there. Well, anyone can do that. I don't think you even have to be alive to sit on a pew, right? That is not valuable by itself. So what you're testing for is whether you are in the faith or not, or whether Jesus Christ is in you. Paul is not saying this as a threat. He's saying you need to make a critical assessment of who you are, take inventory of what you do or what you believe, and then examine yourselves for the reality of who you are rather than what you want to project to others or what you want to believe yourself. You need to know the truth, because it's the truth that will set you free. Self-deception never set anyone free. Never did. But the truth sets everyone free. A fairy tale version of Christianity is no better than bowing down to an ancient idol. They're both false religions. They're both false religions. And these things will never be true for you if your treasure is not in heaven. But if it is, then it will all be true, and you'll see that for what it is. Matthew 12, verse 30, Jesus says, he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. Either your treasure is in heaven or it's here in this life. There is no third possibility. Either you're on the narrow way or you're on the wide path. There is no third alternative. You're either walking in the light or you're stumbling in darkness. There is no, you know, gray area here. No one can serve two masters. No one here or anywhere is above the law. You cannot claim to be exempt from this. You cannot alter Jesus' own words. And every person chooses which master they're going to serve, the one who gives him life or the one who brings him death. You get to choose. There's the freedom part of it. You get to choose. Someone says, well, I've learned how to make all this work. I'm all religious and spiritual and church person when I need to be, but I also know how to have a good time with my friends or keep an active social calendar or fill my head with worldly ambitions. Jesus calls that person a liar. You cannot do both. And you ought to remember that there are no liars in heaven. His Sermon on the Mount is not meant to be merely read and dissected. It is meant to prick our hearts and prick our consciences and convict us of the truth, not to destroy us, but rather to save us from ourselves most often. Remember my introduction. Life is uncertain. The world is in a state of deterioration. Your future is unknown. Jesus says, leave your treasures with me. There's a place where the effects of nature cannot destroy and the wickedness of men cannot steal. You'll be safe in this life. Be safe for the life to come. That's actually what Paul did, by the way. If you read 2 Timothy 1:12, that's exactly what it says. I know whom I believe, and I'm convinced that he is able to guard what I've entrusted to him to that day. I gave my treasure to Christ. And Paul has no regrets now for having done that, and neither will you in the day to come. Jesus has proven himself worthy of your trust, worthy of your confidence. If the Father can trust Jesus to govern his own kingdom, then certainly you should trust Jesus to govern your small, in comparison, life. Jesus doesn't want to beat you over the head with all your mistakes, but he doesn't want you to continue in them either. 2 Peter 3:9 says that God is patient toward you, not wishing for anyone to perish, but for all to come to repentance. That is still true today, just as true as when Peter said it. First of all, that God is patient toward you. You're still here. You still have hope. You still have an opportunity. But he wishes for you to come to your senses and repent of what you've been doing wrong. That's what he needs for you. That's what you should be focusing on right now. Let me leave you with this. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Jesus is in heaven, and he wants you there with him. He wants you there with him. I can't think of a better way to end that lesson right there, that Jesus is in heaven, and he wants you and I with him. He wants me with him. He wants you with him. That's what we should focus on. Now we should be asking ourselves, what must I do then to be with him? Okay, and hopefully that will take care of itself. If I can help you in any way, if you got questions that I haven't addressed here and that you need to have answered, then you ask me, and I'll do my best to address those, or someone else can do that too. But let's get those things resolved. Let's do what we need to do. If there's anyone here that is ready to become a Christian, be baptized into Christ, here's your opportunity. This is the gospel call. Or if you have other needs, spiritual needs we can help you with, let us do so as we stand and sing the song that Bob has selected.